right. Basically set, yeah.
Okay. Simon Forman is now going to talk about his project, Zerblin, and I will vacate the stage. Simon.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. My name is Simon. First thing I want to say is this isn't a really well-rounded, polished programming system. It's something that it occurred to me a couple years ago, and I've worked on it on and off, making demonstration models. Essentially, what happens is if I tell someone who doesn't know about programming about this, they're like, wow, that's really great. What does it do? What do you use it for? And if I tell people that are programmers about it, their general response, and it's only been a few, like a handful, their response is along the lines of, well, that would be really cool, but it's, it sounds totally impossible. So I had to go ahead and make an actual working demo model. And I wrote that in Python. The actual Zerblin system doesn't exist. And if it did exist, it wouldn't be written in Python. But Python's good for rapid application development and stuff like that. So that's what I used it for. Now, things are getting cut off there. So I'm going to have to be careful here. All right, this is the first thing that you see. It's a regular text window. You can type into it. You can edit it. The Zerblin system, what I'm going to tell you is, first of all, it's a user interface, much like a GUI. If you have the command line, then you got the window system. For, you know, this is another type of way to interface with your computer more than anything. It's also very, very good for programming. I'll show you some of that. But essentially, the mouse does most of what you would do to interact with the computer. Zerblin requires a three-button mouse. It borrows from a system called Oberon, which probably not very many of you have heard of. It's in the same, it's a language and operating system. It's in the same family as Pascal and Modula. It's a complete operating system. It's object-oriented, and it's really, really neat. It's very tiny. It's old. It's been around a long time. Go check it out, Oberon. You know, if you punch Oberon in a search thing, you'll get the moon of one of the planets, you'll get the king of the fairies, and you'll get this operating system. So the cut, copy, and paste is in the mouse. You use the, this won't make a lot of sense, but you use the right-hand button to select things, and you use the left-hand button to point. Can you all see the cursor tracking the mouse there? All right, and you see how the selection and the cursor are independent of each other. All right, so if you want to copy something, like let's say I want to copy the word stack here. It's copied, and I want to put it down here. There it is. All right. Now, I don't have to use any of the keyboard shortcuts. I don't even have to right-click and click on a menu. It's all in the mouse. And the way it works, you select with the right, and if you, while you're selecting, you click the middle button, you'll copy the selection to the clipboard. While you're selecting, if you click the opposite button, the left button, you'll cut the selection to the clipboard. All right? It sounds really kind of almost trivial until you start to use it. Once you get used to it, you don't want to go back. It's all you're copying, pasting, a lot of what you do is right in the mouse. You can keep your other hand in your pocket. Not, or, you know, on the table or with holding your coffee. Yeah, on the keyboard. Although if you keep your hand on the keyboard, you won't be using it that much. The whole point is that when they came up with the Oberon system, they discovered that 80% of the time or 80% of the text that you need is already on the screen somewhere. So one of the basic concepts in Oberon that I adopted for this is that all the text is active, title bars, etc. You can all select it, copy it, paste it. It's all, most of the time, the text that you need when you need some piece of text for something to do, it's already on your screen somewhere. So if you can just copy and paste it without even touching the keyboard, it's fast. Once you get used to it, it's really fast. So, and then pointing is the same. If you have something on the keyboard, or excuse me, if you have something on the clipboard, I can point here and cut it out, or I can, I can do like this and make copies of it, yada, yada, yada. All right, now, let's get rid of that stuff since we don't want it. All right, got rid of that. Now, what's going on? Where is this clipboard? It's not the actual normal clipboard, all right? There's more to the system. What you have is a stack. Now, if you're programmers, you all know what a stack is. It's first in, last out, queue. If you don't know what a stack is, if you're not a programmer, relax, it's okay. You already do know what a stack is. The thing that most people use as an example is a stack of plates in a cafeteria, where it's a spring-loaded stack, and you put plates on the top and you take them back off. That's what a stack is. And we have one here. You can see that there's a math string. Is that visible or is it cut off? Okay. So it says math, that's the string. And I can, like, for instance, put it right here. And you see, I cut it so it comes off the stack, but I can also paste and it'll stay on the stack. All right, is everyone cool on that? So you got this stack, you cut and paste things on and off of the stack. It's just like a clipboard, except that it can have more things on it. All right? Actually, Microsoft has a feature in Microsoft Word and some other things where they have a multiple selection stack, and you can copy things, and it'll pop up this weird window. The first time I saw it, I didn't know what it was, but it allows you to select the different things that you've copied and paste them in. So it's been kind of used before, this idea of the stack. All right, moving right along. If you look down here, you see that we have things like print the stack. All right, let me bring this up. And there'll be some other garbage, but you'll see that the stack is in there too. All right, this from here, sequence word, K-stack, math, that's the stack, and it's inside printout of a message. There's a message loop where you send messages to the system, they cause certain things to happen, and then update is given back to the graphical subsection, which you're going to see in a second. And that's how it shows you what's going on. It's through a standard message loop. It implements a simple form of object orientation, but you have these messages. And the basic thing is, like, where's drop? Is a command to drop items off the stack. And you see as I'm doing it, do you see the stack is disappearing and then now the stack is empty? So, the word is drop. You see it there? Yeah, now here's one of the coolest bits. The middle button, the reason why we have three buttons, the middle button is the command execution button. You click on the middle button on any of these words here, and it'll all execute a command, okay? So, for instance, if you click on the word 23 and 18, it will put the integers 23 and 18 on the stack. And if you click on duplicate, it will duplicate the top item on the stack. Drop will drop the top item. Swap will alternate them, all right? Then over copies the second down item over the topmost item. So watch what that does when I execute it twice. I get a copy of both the pair of integers. All right. Then down here we have some integer mathematics. Let's say I want to add them together, then multiply these, and then swap and divide. And there is my answer. So you got a calculator. And all you really have is a modified clipboard and a text window. Okay, so let's say I wanted to create a new function. Let's say I have the number 23, and I want to get the square of 23. I can duplicate it on the stack, and then click multiply, and get the square of 23. All right? So the operation duplicate, followed by the operation multiply, is equivalent of the operation square for a certain range of input data. You know, for integers or floats of a certain, you know, well, actually, I think that will work for all integers and floats, even negative ones and whatnot. So how do you go ahead and do this? All right, just to recap real quick, you've got a set of commands. Each command is well-defined. It takes a certain number of inputs, and it gives out a certain number of outputs from the stack. The stack is like your data palette. You can literally think of yourself as an artist. You've got a palette. You're putting items on the stack. You're going to do stuff with them, manipulate them. But you didn't want to have to click a bunch of buttons every time you want to do something. So the next phase is to create a sequence of commands that will execute all at once when you do it. All right, now, because it's getting cut off here, I want to make sure my title bar is in there. Okay, so we're going to an addition of numbers. We're going to put duplicate on the stack and I multiply on the stack. These are the command objects that actually do the functions. We'll put them over here on the graphic side. All right, now we have imul and we have duplicate. So just to make sure, we put 18, duplicate, imul. Sure enough, that's square. Everything's cool. So we want to do them together at once. We'll create a new sequential executable word. All right. One of the very basic things that all computer programs have is that you execute one thing after the other. All right. You execute one thing after another. So we have a sequential word, and its only job is to execute one command after another. So we take the duplicate word and give it to there, and we take the multiply word and give it to there. And you see it says relaxed sequential executable word. The relaxed part means that it's not checking its words to make sure that they match each other. The normal, non-relaxed, or strict, it's not really called strict, this is called sequential executable word, it checks its subchildren words, it checks their inputs and outputs, and makes sure that they match. Now, for instance, if you tried to take a float, 2.1, and you put the floating point number on the stack, and then you say imul times the float times an integer, no thank you, it doesn't like it. It says, inserts self stack okay on the message stack and says there's an assertion error. Now, I could give it can give you more detailed errors, but basically most of the time you can figure out what's wrong. That error message window popping up, that's something that the new Python 2.3 version of the Tkinter interface, this whole thing is done by an interface system called Tkinter, and it is built on top of TCL, and this GUI system here is just a demo. It's just like a front end that I built to show off basically that this works. Because I would tell programmers about some of the things you're going to hear in a few minutes, and they wouldn't believe me. Which is kind of gratifying in a way, because then you know you're really onto something if people can't even believe it, even though it's pretty simple. So we have this new word here. It creates... Oh, yeah, I was going to show you. Oh, I did show you. If you execute it as an error, float and stuff is still on the stack. So let's get rid of the floating point number. And we'll put 23 on the stack, and we'll execute this one. And sure enough, the answer is 529. Did you all see that? I just clicked on this rather than those two. All right, and I'm going to get a copy of this one and put it on the stack, and we'll give it a name. Now, because the integer mathematics start with the letter I, let's call it I square, and we'll put the string on the stack, all right, and we'll use this word setName. A setName takes a string and an executable object and sets the name. And then once you have the word with a name, you can use the inscribe command. Now, the word I square is now inscribed into what's called the dictionary, which is just, if you know Python, it's a dictionary is a dictionary. If you don't, a dictionary is still a dictionary. It's a listing of words that have, you know, a definition. So now you have in your dictionary the word I square, which will execute, you know, duplicate, multiply. So we can get rid of this. We can clear it out of our workspace. We can drop all this crap off of here. And we're back to what we started with, only now we have a new command. All right, and the command, just so you are all on the same page, I square, 529. Okay, so you don't have to use things this simple. Now, if we scroll down here, the demo for the C front end. Now, when I was writing this last night at 3 a.m., I forgot to put this stuff in. So here I am. For the first time using the keyboard, like a pro. All right. See, oh wait, is it? Sorry? Okay, now these words I wrote last night, you can actually create new words in Python or in other languages fairly simply. It's not a very difficult thing to create these new basic words. So what we have here is C-scan, which is a C language scanner, C-parse. Oh, what's going on? Oh, it's a capital C, that's why. Yes, using the keyboard like a pro. You can tell I've got a lot of keyboard experience here. Let's do it again. All right. So now we have these three commands. Cscan is a C language scanner. Cparse is a C language parser. And CAST to Zerblin translates a C language abstract syntax tree to what, for better lack of a better term, I'm calling a Zerblin trees. You saw a miniature Zerblin tree, the I square command. So the way this works is you get a copy of some C code, you scan the C code into a list of tokens, then you parse the list of tokens into what's called an abstract syntax tree. Now this, when you're compiling a language, this is a fairly standard thing that is done. You have a string of characters that represent the language, or the program in the language, and to compile it, you scan the string and break it up into logical tokens, which are all the little things that make sense to the language as opposed to the word processor. So once you have the language structure and tokens, you parse it, and it creates an abstract syntax tree. Now, the abstract syntax tree, this is a common like computer science thing. Abstract syntax tree is the structure of the program in its syntax. And a compiler takes a syntax tree. This doesn't make a lot of sense. There's not much more information I can give you without going way off on a tangent. So a compiler will take the tree of the syntax and traverse it and emit assembler language code, and that's how compilation is done. So what we just did was we took a plain vanilla, and I want to mention, I should know the guy's name, but I hadn't had time to look it up. There's a package called Spark that's a language compiler, a compiler for Python, and that's what I used to write the C front end, and that was really simple. I hit up Google for a grammar for the C language. I splice it into the Spark generic parser framework, and these two functions here just plopped right out. They're pretty much trivial as like compilation gets. This was a little tricky, and it's not complete. If you give it any sort of arbitrary C language code, it will generally break, although it can do some interesting things, and it will demonstrate the for loop here. So without further ado, let's create a new sequence word. Give it all these. Oops. I tried to disable the mouse pad, but I still hit it with the palm of my hand. So I just built this tree, and it'll scan, parse, and then create the Zerblin stuff. And just to show you that it all works as one unit, we'll take a copy of this, we'll execute that, get rid of this since we don't want it. Drop that off. Now this set word, relax, blah, 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 that is the Zerblin form of the C language tree, and it looks like this. As you can see, it's kind of gnarly. Yeah, C is not a simplified system. It's really simple from, you know, when it was created, but in terms of what C is doing underneath there, it does a lot of interesting different stuff. So what you're looking at is not the abstract syntax tree of that snippet of C code. What you're looking at is a Zerblin tree that will do the same thing as that C code. Now, I lost my glasses. I have these. They're prescription, but they're sunglasses. So it's not that I'm just, like, too cool. It's that I need to, like, I need to see what's typed on here for the part where we're talking about the C language. Okay, so you've got a standard C snippet here. Here's the descriptor. It returns void, takes an integer h, it does some pretty nonsensical crap to Mr. H, sets it equal to 20, then you have a really simple for statement where it says k equals 0, while k is less than or equal to 10, do h equals 10, and then increment k, alright? And then again at the end we do h equals 20. Now this doesn't do anything, but it except be a good example for the parsing. Okay, so what you have in the AST tree, you start out with G, which is the function G, all right? It has a compound statement inside of it, which consists of H, the for statement, and the assignment statement, right? This is one of the statements. This is the for statement. There's for word right there. And this is the other H equals 20. All right, now what we have here is we have H. You see, we have a variable h equals none. Excuse me a second. Drop. Drop is a useful one, so I'm going to sort of customize my workspace here. So we have H, put 20 on the stack. We have set value word, which will set H equal to 20. It also consumes the constant, and it consumes the reference to H. But if we put H again, see that H now equals 20, okay? So that is the H equals 20. This tree right here is H equals 20 in C. It does the same thing. You can take a copy of it and put it out here. And this is a completely independent command. It has nothing to do with the original tree whatsoever. It doesn't care anything about it. It's completely independent. It does share the reference to the same variable H. But other than that, like, you could chop this off and, you know, do something else with it. It really doesn't care. It doesn't mind. You know, it's all right. So what we're going to do, where's meta commands? Open toggle. We're going to give that one an open toggle. And this also is H20 set value word. All right, and we're going to close those off. So we're going to, like a surgeon, we're going to cover up the parts that we're not interested in. All right. So those are H equal 20. Now the interesting part, the reason why I chose this little snippet as an example is for statement. So we have this for word. Now in order to execute the for statement, the first thing you have to do is set k equal to 0 and then evaluate this thing to see whether it's all right to go. So you have k equals 0. This is k equals 0 right here. All right. And if you don't believe me, we can put k on there and you see k equals none. And we can execute this and you see k equals 0. Now what happened was there was already a reference to k. When this executed, it put another reference on, it put the value on, and then it set equal. All right? And again, each subtree is completely independent of the action of the tree above it. All right? It's essentially a procedure call. So we're going to get rid of k so we don't have to worry about it. And we're going to put open toggle on there because we know what that one does. Then we come down here, and this is k get value word. Three guesses what that does. It gets the value of k, and put the constant 10 on there, and then we have a comparator here, which will say, yes, it's true. K is less than or equal to 10. Everything is all right. So then you jump out into this. Now, if you can tell that the border on that one is a little thicker, that's a loop word. Now, loop word has a very simple job. Sequential word has a simple job. Loop word's job is pretty simple, too. Loop word pops the top item off the stack, checks to see whether it's 0 or not. If the top value that it just popped is anything other than 0, loop word executes its single child. If the top word value on the stack that loop pops is 0, loop doesn't do anything. It's extremely simple. So it comes in and does a statement 1. The first thing it does, it says h is equal to 10, h10 set value word. All right, that's this leg right here. And then it says k increment, and if we put k on there, you see the k now equals 1, all right? And then that goes back in, and then k set value constant 10 less than or equal. It checks the condition again, all right? So loop will keep executing until the condition is false, and then it will go and execute the last thing. So essentially, if I command click on this right now, it just did this. Now, how do you know? Oh, what the hell is that? Oh, I accidentally hit something. Sorry. So basically, it executes that. Now, let's say, all right, this is, hold on a minute. We took a piece of C language, all right? We compiled it halfway. It's almost like you're compiling it up to the abstract syntax tree and stopping your compiler and opening it up and digging down into the roots of your program. All right? And once it's designed like this, you can check various different things. You can check that all of the various parts of it relate to each other properly in terms of type checking, in terms of arguments, in terms of dependencies. You can have it so that if you create something here while you're working and you want it to be in C language, and you reference or you call a function in the standard library that will automatically include the compiler directive to include the standard library. I hope that made sense. I think that's what I was trying to say. But so basically here we are working with this. Why would this be interesting? Well, let's say we want to check something. Remember this command here, .s, prints the stack. Right there. Doesn't make much sense because all the messages are in the problem. But anyway, here's the relational expression. Let's say I want to know what the value of k is. Let's say I'm worried that as k is going through the loop, it's not incrementing properly. So I'm going to add the .s command here, right after the 10, but before those values are consumed in the comparison. Now, I want you to notice something. When I added that down here, it also added down here. And why is that? It's because those two, this relational expression and this relational expression, are the same relational expression here. All right? Now, this one and this one are identical, but they're completely separate because they're two separate lines. This one and this one are the same actual one. There's two graphical representations of it, but underneath there, inside the machinery, there's only one instance of the underlying tree. So when I modified one by adding the .s, it modified the rest of the tree, or the other part of the tree, and it popped up here, down on the yarn. And the reason why that's cool is because if you have one version of a command, you can include it in various different places, and as you edit that command, I can actually take a copy of this and put it quite separately over here and mess around with it, right? And then just delete it off of here and then not even worry about it. And the command changes will be reflected inside all the rest of my system. Occasionally that's undesirable, and you have to create a duplicate of a piece of the tree and modify that one because you don't want it to affect other stuff. But when you do want it to, it's already built in. So now we have this whole tree, we have the .s in there, and what is that going to do for us? It's basically a debug statement. All right? Now I had some junk on there, so I'm going to get rid of that. I won't be bothered by this anymore. I'll print this out. Oops, come on now. Print this out so you get it sort of clear. Execute this, and you can see, can you see? Is it cut off? There you go. There's k, and there's a comparison value all the way down. And sure enough, k equals 11, and the loop stops. All right? So the equivalent is on 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Oh, wow. Before Q&A? Okay. All right, so wrapping it up, basically, you just saw me put a debug statement in the middle of this little relational statement here. I put a debug switch right in between that there. I was going to talk about code translation. It's a little tricky, but a lot less tricky than you'd think. You basically have to translate the AST from C language into Zerblin style, and then use pattern recognition on the tree to translate back out into Python. There's a ton more to this system. Let me recap the basics, and I'll tell you a couple little things, and we'll do Q&A. Basically, you have a dictionary of commands. The commands are atomic, well-understood actions that can be built-in things. They can be API calls from any sort of library that you have. They can be calls into shared objects or dynamic libraries. Basically, like you can load in a DLL or a shared object file and call into it. They can be external commands. You can grep is a good example. You can put your command, your arguments to grep, and hit the mouse key on grep and have it execute external commands like that. Remote procedure calls, anything basically can be represented in this tree. I'm getting rid of that. I'm going to inscribe it, so if I want to pull it up later, I can. And it's under the name G. Like I can type G and pop it up and put it on the table and work on it. Let's see what else. Okay. The core of the system, you have the dictionary of commands, you have a stack that's your palette of data, you relate the subcommands by either a sequence, do one thing after the other, loop, do one thing over again based on the results of a test, or branch, and that's do one thing or the other based on the results of a test. With these three relations between these commands, you can model any programming language construct. And because you have a C front end, you can read in source code, you can read in algorithms and data types and things from C and have them in your tree system. There's one or two other things I want to show you. Oh yeah, just real quick. Well, I got 5 minutes left. There's a ton of different things. You can store these trees in, you can serialize them. Python has a serialization module called pickle. You pass the tree to the pickle module and it brings out a string. You can take that string on a disk or on the net to another computer, load it up, and have your complete workspace, including the graphic system, already there. You can send them to friends. You can build new commands. One last thing, and then we'll do Q&A. There's something, new sequence word. Duplicate. New loop word. This is an example of how you use it without another language's input, how you would use it to create on the fly new commands. So tuck, mod, I mean, you already saw the square root or the square command, but there's more interesting ones. Okay, this is the greatest common denominator function. If you have, somebody give me a large integer, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then 580 or 68. All right, I want to find the greatest common denominator. Put that on, execute this word. I didn't do right. Duplicate, zero, tuck, mod, that was the wrong one. So I got it wrong, I had to re-edit. All right, let's get rid of all this crap. Oh, you can have other people come in. This is like a workspace. You can have other people come in as sort of like a multi-user dungeon scenario, and each of you look at the trees and edit them in groups. You know, talk to each other while you're editing the trees. So here's the numbers, greatest common denominator. Now, the interesting thing here is that mod is the only thing that cares about the type of its arguments. Duplicate, drop, duplicate, and tuck are all stack manipulation. So essentially, one thing you could do is replace mod by something that modulates not integers, but polynomials. And then you'd have a function that could find the greatest common factor of two polynomial equations. And this, you know, it's a completely working functional thing you can put in your dictionary. Okay, so that's the rough draft of the simplest stuff that Zerblin does. Okay, any questions? Yes, the first guy here.
So you said earlier that the system was sort of similar to Oberon. It also seems similar since to Plan 9, which uses a lot of this. Are you familiar with Plan 9 at all?
Plan 9?
Plan 9, yeah. It's Plan an operating 9. System from Bell Labs.
I've never heard of Plan 9.
There's a user interface in Plan 9 that does essentially the same stuff with the mouse operations.
Okay.
And I was also just wondering, when you built Zerblin in order to do like all the AST parsing and everything else, what was your model for doing? You just used Spark and a grammar, or did you?
Yeah, I used Spark and a grammar. Translating from the CAST to the Zerblin trees is basically pattern substitution.
All right. Does it handle any other language in C currently, or is it mostly just C-based and imperative language?
Well, you can put a front end to any language that you have the grammar for. Python has a parser built into it in its library, and you can take the Python AST tree, and you have one job to convert Python AST to the Zerblin tree. And it's fairly simple. Anybody else? Back there? I haven't really. I got a gyroscopic presenter mouse that you can like wave around in the air, but that only had two buttons. There's a mapping. There's one file where you change a couple comments, and you can switch from a two-button mouse to a three-button mouse. But as far as more advanced interfacing goes, I haven't done much. I have a friend who's quadriplegic, and I want to do something with galvanic skin response and have it feed into this, but that's not even really related to Zerblin. So no, I haven't done much with other mice. Question?
I'm curious what the stack commands over, tuck, and pass to are.
Over, if you have two items on there, over copies the bottom, the second one over the top. Pass to is required for when you're using the stricter form. They check their arguments. Sometimes you'll need something that has two input arguments, but the output of the previous stage only has one output argument. So you join it with pass two, which essentially does nothing except have two inputs and two outputs. It's sort of like bookkeeping for type checking and stuff. And then what was the other one? Tuck? Tuck is a lot like the opposite of over. It takes the top one and tucks it under the second one. And just by the way, all these commands come from something called forth, which I know some of you have heard of. All right? Forth is really weird. It's really weird, but it has a number of really interesting things. One is that all these trees are essentially forth already. It's almost like this is a IDE for forth. Really, it's sometimes I really get that feeling. This here, this GCD actually is a forth thing that I just did in mine, and it comes out. It's very elegant, that's why I did it. But forth is real close to the assembler, and it's written for almost every single processor. Forth affecandos, port forth to everything. So it'd be real trivial to make this run on top of forth and then have this run on top of every processor made, basically. Just one. Excuse me? Yeah. Yeah. It would be real easy to make this a very simple universal interface. Really easy. In fact, it's mostly already done. Question back here?
This looks really cool on these small problems. It's easy to see how it's applicable. Have you tried applying it to a larger program, like even you know, some C data manipulation? How quickly does it become unwieldy, and what techniques are you using to tame the complexity?
Pretty quickly. As you saw, that tiny little C thing creates this huge tree. This tree is already, you know, like, got extra junk in it. So, yeah, if you're just using it as a pure development thing for more complex programs, it can be kind of unwieldy. You can shut off sections. You can compartmentalize with it really easily. So if you have something that works, you can compartmentalize it and shut it off and put it in your dictionary and forget about it. It makes factoring complex things really easy. One of my ultimate goals for this is I want to be able to put like a large system like Apache or even, you know, God forbid, knock on wood, the Linux kernel into this and be able to, you know, be of benefit to those kind of projects. So, but for now, it's mostly just you have this tree. There's a 3D system. So adding the third dimension already makes it a lot easier to deal with these complex trees. Closing off parts of the tree that you're not dealing with, just like a surgeon where you put the window over just what you're working on. That kind of thing. And you can have people working on different sets. You literally can. Like, I'm working on this branch, and I'm working on that branch. And where the two branches interfere, the system will tell each other. So it's useful. Are there another question right in front of the same guy?
Two questions, actually. Follow-on regarding the Plan 9 window manager is called Acme. And the other thing,
what was that?
The window manager you want to look at is called Acme. It's actually built outside of Plan 9 too, but it has a lot of stuff that might help you.
Okay.
The other question is actually variable scoping inside Zerblin trees. How does it work?
I was wondering if anyone would catch that. Right now, there's really only one scope, and it's the dictionary and the stack. When this comes in as a C thing, these variables, like I can pull this off and I have a separate variable. And its scope is the stack, or excuse me, is the dictionary. The message passing system essentially implements kind of a namespace, but also kind of an object-oriented thing. And I have the idea, like, this is all joined together by an interpreter. You could go inside one of these orbs and have that be a self-contained namespace. Now, if you're trying, the place where it gets really sticky is if you're trying to translate, say, from C to Python, or from some language to some other language, if they don't have completely meshing namespace rules or scoping rules. That can get kind of tricky, but there are ways to work around it. Anyone else? Like, you got another question?
What's called Joy?
J-O-Y?
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
It's a language similar to forth in all the semantics. It's all stack operated and everything else, but it includes pure functional application. So you can do things like macros and everything else that you currently sort of can't do easily inside the procedural language.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, cool. I'll look into that. I'm going to look into the Plan 9 and is it Acme? Okay. Anybody else? Is that a question there? You, sir?
this is just an idea, and I'm not sure if it would work right because I've only had like 30 seconds to think about it.
Okay.
You could have a word that was a push a dictionary on a stack word, like you have a dictionary stack for your scoping.
Yeah.
You might be able to model a lot of languages using something like that.
Yeah. That's, yeah. In fact, that's like one of the things that basically occurred to me is the most likely thing. Consider this whole system, as like one unit. And you could have them nested inside each other, and by putting the dictionary on as the target or the namespace of execution, basically, yeah, you're creating an execution context. That, you know, you can do it that way. Works really well. There you go, sir. Dan?
So it seems like what you've got here is a good way to look at the parsed version of your code and sort of do some experimental runs of it and debugging of what's in it. But it seems like it'd be a lot more useful if after you do some manipulations with it in this alternate representation, you can turn it back into the source language. It seems like that would be really powerful.
Yeah.
Is that something you're planning on doing? Or
definitely. In fact, I ran out of time before the demo where I would have been able to show changing the Python or changing C into Python. If you see, I have the GCD written in a rough C and rough Python here. Writing code back out once it's in this tree form is really easy. The easiest is assembly. It's almost falling off a log to output assembly. Writing other languages is essentially pattern matching. Matching these trees to structures that are the equivalent in that language's abstract syntax tree. Then once you have a abstract syntax tree that's valid, going back to the source code for it is completely easy. Python has a single thing. If you give it an AST tree, it creates the source code or compiles the... It brings it back to the source. So, yeah, that's definitely... One thing I really want is to have multiple language front-end and back-end. I mean, you can read in any language, mess with it, and read it back out in any language. You know, subject to the restrictions that language imposes. So, anybody else? Yes, sir.
Can Zerblin trees manipulate themselves?
Yeah.
Can you? I guess it's probably too late to have an example of that, but I could bother you later.
Well, one thing is whenever you create a new word, like I'll create a new sequential executed word and call it Gonzo, right? So this is really trivial. I'm not even operating on a tree. I'm just operating on this word on the top of the stack. In fact, sorry. Let me get rid of all this crap. Essentially, like, let's say I want, just for Lark, that is one subcommand, and I want to... I didn't implement any, because it's sort of like a security thing. If you can't directly manipulate the stack, then you can't really... There's certain things... Or if you can't directly manipulate the tree, there's certain things you can't do. But let's call it Gonzo. And we'll set its name, and there essentially you're changing the internal meta information of that particular word. And if you write it back out, it now calls itself Gonzo. You can traverse these trees, you can modify the trees by command. You can put like any part of it, you know, on the stack. And then you could say, for instance, turn these three into something else. I'm not sure, but yeah, you can totally do that. I lost track of who.
We have time for two more questions.
Okay, two more questions. There's somebody right there.
Hi. One of the things I think is really interesting is, you know, some people are predicting that up to 70% of programmers in the future won't be sort of our traditional programmers, but more like business people. You can imagine things like, you know, IRS accountants using some sort of simple programming menu system like this that can be created. You can see teams of IRS accountants. You can see real estate people working to put together a deal, all kinds of business people. Something like this would be really interesting. I think it would be really good for a team-based, if multiple people could be using it. So I think there's a really a huge opportunity. The other thing I really like about
Thank
it is... you know, one of the reasons that, you know, programmers are highly valued is because of their ability to do spatial reasoning in their heads. And this kind of lowers the bar because, you know, you can stick it out in front of you so more people can be able to program. So that, I just, you know, just wanted to make some comments that you should be thinking about looking at some of the easiest and most, you know, basic programming stuff, you know, maybe Excel for applications, or you know, some POM stuff, or any customized menus where that are very popular, where people are clicking buttons, like filling out a visa application. Some people argue that filling out visa applications is almost like programming, because when it goes into the mainframe on the back end, it's almost like you know, programming. So stuff like that could be really useful.
Thanks for that's more a comment than a question, but yeah. Like all of that across the board, yeah. I wanted something simple enough for anybody to use. We got the next question here. Simple enough for like kids to use. See, I have a friend, he'll sit there and play Final Fantasy, and there's like all these weapons and these gadgets he put in the weapons, and he turns around, there's a question guy right here. And he won't learn to use an IRC client so we can chat. It's the most frustrating thing. And he's smart enough. You know, he's like, oh, it's too hard. So yeah, I want to make something totally easy, and also something like, if I'm sitting around and I figure out something cool, I can build a tree to do it and send it to Joe Schmo. I can call out my buddy and be like, hey, I'm going to email you this thing I just figured out, you know, and he can pull up the tree and understand it. And that, like you said, it lowers the bar. It makes it just much more, it's right there in your face. You know, there's no hidden stuff. So it's like Tinker Toys.
So my question was, you said you don't allow any direct stack manipulations, but that seems like it'll prevent you from things.
No, I misspoke.
Can you do things like, what I really want to know is, can you copy the whole stack so you can implement continuations and stuff like that in this language?
As it stands now, no, but there's no inherent reason why not. One thing, I used to have it so that whenever you executed a command from the mouse, that it would save the current stack and the current dictionary to a file. And then you could restart. I'm not sure about continuations. I've heard of them, and you probably used them without knowing it.
Most languages don't have them. So a continuation, you copy the whole stack, and then so you can return from a function, and then later return back into this function and have the stack the same way it was when you returned from it. So you can go up and down the stack, basically.
In fact, the more advanced system, this goes one better. It has eigenstates, where you execute a command. For instance, let's say the command's ambiguous. The system will split. It has a parallel operator that I didn't show off because it's not fully implemented yet, but it's not difficult. It's there. But it will split into alternate realities and try each different possibility for the ambiguous command and present, you know, up to a point, the results to the user, and then the user can select which of those realities were cool. But, you know, like you do with your video games, you save games. But essentially, like if you want to do that, you could get a copy of the system of the stack and the dictionary at a certain point, then execute a bunch of different commands, and then come back to that point. It has what a faculty I call back time, just like you have backspace, that it keeps a record of itself as it progresses, and you can go back in time to any particular point, branch off into another direction. You know, and it seems like from that capability, you could implement the continuations you're talking about. All right, I think those are the two questions I have. Any more, or am I done?
Nope, that's all.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, you guys. Thank you.